this crumbs vicarious fate. I guess there's hope for me yet. I hope there's hope for me yet. But I escape into ink and paper. Still I return to watch and remember, yes, time when it was my dress, time when it was my mouth, time when it was our breath. I am out here on the edge, wishing it was me instead.
Thank you so much for dropping by.
It's my pleasure, Roz.
It's been such a long time.
Yeah. You are a sweetheart to have me here. Thank you so much.
Well, you take care of yourself.
Thank you. You too.
Hope to see you soon. And don't forget, folks, she's got a new album called Welcome Home, and you can find it at carolynaiken.com, A-I-K-E-N. This has been Folksine. I'm Roz Larman with Peter Cutler at the controls from the Longhouse, Northridge, California, USA. Thanks to Wendy Wellman for use the Longhouse, and Peter and I will see you soon. You just heard our special feature with our guest, Caroline Aiken. Recorded for Folksine, June 28, 2012, Longhouse, Northridge, California, USA. Engineer is Peter Cutler. And you can find Caroline at carolineaiken.com. This has been Folksine. I am Roz Larman. Folksine's host and producer rail by Peter Cutler and Roz Larman from the studios of Folksine, Woodland Hills, California, USA. Have a great week, folks. Peter and I will see you real soon.
This is PRN.FM. Tune in anytime for the latest in progressive news and ideas. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Tracker of Truth. Michael C. Rupert hosts the Lifeboat Hour, a nightclub at the end of the world, every Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, right after the Gary Null Show, here on the Progressive Radio Network, only at PRN.FM. Join us every Sunday as we mix music, some from my band New White Trash, Earth-based spirituality, new scientific truths, analysis, and hard facts to take a look at the week just passed and to get ready for the one that's coming. We may not solve anything, but we always come out with better understandings, a fresh perspective, and the inner strength to inch our way forward towards a brighter and better and more just future. The Lifeboat Hour, Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM, your source for progressive radio that makes a difference.
Gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. I'm Doug Rocky, and I'm calling again. We're coming in from the dreary state of Illinois right now. Our weather goes up and down. Anyhow, we're over the next few weeks, really interesting fun. We'll do something a little bit different. One thing that's extremely important, as all warriors and everybody comes back from war and everything, is relaxation and having fun. Well, April is Library Month. And so what we're going to be doing here for the next few weeks, tonight and then the next few weeks, we're going to talk to a whole bunch of different authors that have written incredible books about how they write their books, what's involved in writing books, have them read some of their books, and give us an idea of what you can go and find in a library. We'll have some librarians come on to talk about the libraries, and we're going to have a lot of fun. And before we get started with our guests tonight, Denise, are you on by chance? Okay, Denise has been up in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of things, events have been happening up there, and she's probably still traveling. So anyhow, let's go to our guest. Sarah, are you available?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Welcome to Warrior Connection.
I'm pleased to be here.
Well, we have Sarah Weiserman, and a.k.a. is your author's name is Sally Underhill?
That's my maiden name.
Okay.
My author name is Sarah Wisserman.
Okay, Sarah Wisserman. Fantastic. Anyhow, Sarah is one of the local authors here in East Central Illinois, and you're a professional archaeologist, aren't you?
That's correct.
Wow, at the University of Illinois.
That's right. I work for the Illinois State Archaeological Survey.
Wow, go Illini. Several of us here are Illini. We got a lot of people all over that have been in the military, definitely connected to the University of Illinois. Anyhow, Sarah, could you tell us something about your books? You've written a whole bunch of interesting books as I look through them here. Give us an idea of what's involved in writing a book, how you got to decide to write books, and what they're all about.
Okay, I got involved writing archaeological fiction because I love archaeology and I wanted to convey some of that love to other people. And I got started when I was working on a mummy project at the University of Illinois, a real mummy project where we took an Illinois museum mummy from the Spurlock Museum on campus to our local hospital for x-rays and CAT scans to find out more about what was inside it. And when I was writing up the true story of this mummy in our investigation, I remembered what our old attic museum was like. Creepy old attic with pigeons flying in and out, no air conditioning, artifacts, cheek by jowl all over the place. And that was the beginning of my first murder mystery called Bound for Eternity. And in it, I have a protagonist who's a lot like myself. Her name is Lisa Donahue. She has a background in archaeology. She falls in love with the doctor, but in the fictional story, it's the doctor who helps her with the mummy investigation. In my case, it's a pathologist, my husband Charlie. So the mummy story is the first one, and then I wrote a sequel called The Dead Sea Codex that actually takes Lisa Donahue back earlier in time to where she was a student in Israel, and she stumbles on an ancient manuscript that Christian fanatics would kill to prevent publication of. So that's based on my junior year in Israel a long, long time ago. And then book three is The Fall of Augustus, where I write about moving the museum from one location on campus to another, and that's also based on a true story. But people getting crushed by statues was not part of the program, and that's definitely fictional. The fourth book in that series is called House of the Sphinx, and I can blame that partly on my husband because we finally got me to Egypt after wanting to see it all my life, and I was telling him about an archaeological plot on the way home, and he said, well, that sounds okay, but why don't you add something? And I said, well, like what? And he said, how about a little bioterrorism?
Boy, that fits into the military issue real quick.
Yeah, so that he said, okay, how about smallpox? So we spent the rest of the flight talking about smallpox and where I might go for information about that. So that was the beginning of a plot where Lisa and her radiologist husband, James, stumble upon a terrorist plot to infect Western tourists with smallpox. So that's book four in the series. And then I did a complete departure, a local novel set in the 1920s, this time starring a male physician with a hobby of archaeology. He also has a German wife and a flapper daughter. And in The Bootlegger's Nephew, he uses his knowledge of local archaeology and geography to solve a murder and to put an end to the activities of a gang of bootleggers.
Wow, sounds kind of interesting. For those of you who haven't been to the University of Illinois, I got my doctorate at the University of Illinois. But what she's referring to is the great Lincoln Hall. And Lincoln Hall has just been completely renovated, and they just had a grand opening. And the World Heritage Museum at one time, what you're talking about, was located in the upper bounds of Lincoln Hall. And then a few years ago, they moved over to three and a half interesting years
up there as part of a small staff of people running that museum. And one of the things I remember is having to close up the museum at night, and we had an archaic security system, and you had to push a button and then call the campus police, and they'd say, okay, you have 30 seconds to get out of there, and then run down the stairs in the dark. So that scene gets used in Bound for Eternity.
Wow. And those, I know for those individuals, if you do visit the University of Illinois, I think it goes back into history, one of the great statues of Abraham Lincoln, who was the President of the United States, is located in Lincoln Hall. And this statue has been rubbed by everybody and their brother for many, many years, brushing up his nose, rubbing his nose for good luck. That's all also located in the Lincoln Hall, and now it's been reestablished back in there, I understand, too.
It's gorgeous. I visited recently, and I rode the elevator, the old elevator, to the top floor, and I couldn't recognize it. It was so different. They've got real lighting up there and bathrooms and climate control, and it doesn't look anything like our old attic museum.
Yeah, I think I had my first walked into that museum, it's over 40 years ago for myself, and when I got to the U of I in the 70s, obviously, we were involved in going to classes and everything in there. Well, the first book you're talking about, Bound for Eternity, and you're talking about the mummy. Well, this mummy really does exist, and it is now located in the Spurlock Museum, but it was in Lincoln Hall. Could you tell us a little bit more about Bound for Eternity? Because here we're dealing with reality and also a book.
Yeah, and because it was my first venture into fiction, it took me halfway through the book before I realized, hey, this is fiction. I can change the ending. So in the real-life investigation, we were not allowed to do anything non-destructive to the mummy because it was going on display, and so we just wanted to find out more about the age and the sex of the person inside the mummy and something about Egyptian embalming customs. But in the fictional account, in Bound for Eternity, I have Lisa and James get permission to send a pediatric endoscope up the mummy and actually find out that it was a little boy, and then they find a mummy tag, which we did not find in real life, identifying the child as the son of a Roman wine merchant and an Egyptian woman. So I had the great satisfaction of completing the story to, the way I wanted it to come out, and have the story of the mummy exhibit somewhat similar to what happened to us. But, of course, the people who get killed off in the story bear no resemblance to any colleagues I've ever had.
Fascinating. So how did you get involved? I mean, you're actually doing all this research on a real live mummy that's been at the University of Illinois for, over 100 years, hasn't it, or something like that?
No, the mummy was acquired in 1989 when one of our previous directors realized what a draw it would be for school children to have a human mummy in the collection, because we already had some animal mummies. And she was certainly right about that, because I've given tours to sixth graders, and when you get to the mummy, they all want to see it, and one of them always says, "Is there a real person in there?" And now I can say, yes, there is, and he or she was about your age. And that really gets to them.
So what did you find out during your investigations? What led to the book? What did you find out about this mummy?
The first finding was that the mummy was a child, and we got that information from X-raying it at the College of Veterinary Medicine in the large animal clinic. And you could see right away in the first X-ray of the head that there are adult teeth coming in behind baby teeth in the skull. And then you move down the body, and you see that the growth plates aren't fused yet. So right away, the radiologist was able to say, this is not an adult. You have a child. But you can't tell whether it's a girl or a boy because the pelvis is not sufficiently developed. So we had a mystery right away in real life. You know, who was this child? Who was his mother and father? How did he live in Roman Egypt? What happened to him or her? And as the investigation progressed, we discovered from the CAT scans that the mummy had a broken head, but we didn't know whether the broken head occurred at the time of death or after death. You know, so that kind of added to the mystery and added to my desire to complete the story in fictional form.
Wow. Do you have any idea what period of time did this mummy exist, and what period of time does your book start and then continue on?
Okay. The mummy dates to the Roman period, and we know that from the external decoration of Egyptian gods marching down the front combined with a Roman face portrait, which is very typical of about 100 AD, so still within the Roman period, the Roman occupation of Egypt. And let's see, my book takes place roughly sometime in the early 90s. I wanted to keep it fairly contemporary, and in my first novel, at least, I wanted to be able to use cell phones and not worry too much about anachronisms and trying to project myself much further into the past. As I developed a little more confidence as an author and learned how to do the research, then I was more comfortable going back to the 70s for the Dead Sea Codex, and finally to the 1920s for The Bootlegger's Nephew.
Wow. So on this book, Bound for Eternity, what starts out, or what is the theme all the way through, and how does it end up?
Okay, the theme is that Lisa Donahue, who is a museum curator, discovers that an Egyptian mummy holds the clues to two murders in her Boston museum. I took the old World Heritage Museum and moved it to Boston in case somebody read it and decided to sue me. So I thought I'd go back to my old stomping grounds in Boston where I grew up. So the story is basically how Lisa comes back from taking the mummy to be x-rayed and discovers the body of a colleague in the mummy case in the museum. And it's the body of the registrar, and she has no idea why Marion was murdered, what happened to her. So that sparks the beginning of the story, and the rest of the story is sort of the double investigation of the actual murder, and another murder occurs later on of one of the other staff, and then the secondary story of the mummy investigation, how Lisa and James work together to solve that, and incidentally, they get to like each other very much.
Sounds like an exciting book. It's one of those that once you pick up, it's hard to set down?
I hope so.
The Dead Sea Codex. Boy, I mean, we're going back into history there.
Well, I discovered that doing the research for the fiction writing is not too different from what I've been doing the rest of my life. I mean, the one thing I can say for the academic background is that it does train you how to do research. And now that we have all these tools of the Internet, and as a U of I staff member, I have access to the archives over in the Urbana Library, so I can sit at home in my pajamas and pull up all this information about the 1920s. And when I was working on Codex, I didn't really want to go back to Jerusalem and get blown up by a bomber, so I pretended I was back there and pulled up maps and names of restaurants and Arabic phrases and information on the Dead Sea Scrolls and got out all my books and atlases and just had my writing room just covered with piles of interesting stuff. And then after you do all the research, you can only use a fraction of it in the book or your readers would get bored. So I try to avoid doing information dumps and make sure that any history I put in there is integrated with the plot and makes people want to read more.
So it sounds like research is the key to being a good writer, as it is to being a good scientist, as a good teacher, or anything. But also the same thing with the military. We have to do our research, in other words, to get our medical care and take care of ourselves and get everything put together in our life. So on the Dead Sea Codex, so what was the primary theme on that book, and where does it go to?
The premise is not a Dead Sea Scroll, but a more recent manuscript, something like one of the Gnostic Gospels, the very early manuscripts that made it into our New Testament, and what was left out because the religious officials who decided what would be codified and what would be Orthodox Christian belief left out an awful lot of stuff from the first century AD around the time of Christ. And so I was fascinated with that. And the Codex in my story is a made-up document that actually resembles some of the ones that were found in Egypt. And so in that book, Lisa is a little bit earlier in time. She's 7 years back. She's working for a different museum in Philadelphia, and she's been sent over to collect some information for an exhibit. And she bumps into an old boyfriend from when she was an undergraduate student, and he tells her about a very early manuscript that has just come up on the black market, and they've only got scraps of it. So this book is more of a suspense or thriller where they know something about the opposition, and it's a race to the finish to see who can find the rest of the manuscript first. Lisa and Greg want to save it, and the Christian fanatics who they are up against want to destroy it so it won't get published and won't rock the boat on early Christianity.
Wow. These are fascinating books. The Fall of Augustus, this is about what?
Now, this, I would say in some ways I had my most fun with this book. In this book, Lisa returns to her Boston museum, so it's really the direct sequel to Bound for Eternity. And she's still a curator, but at the beginning of the book, her boss gets killed by a falling statue of the Emperor Augustus, and all of a sudden Lisa is made temporary director of the museum. So here she is involved in another murder investigation. At the same time, they're trying to move this building across campus with thousands and thousands of artifacts. And her staff is behaving very badly. And just to make things worse, the dean decides that Lisa is not going to be the permanent director, but he's going to hire someone else over her head. And he brings in the woman who made Lisa's life absolutely miserable earlier in her career. So you've got jealous colleagues, confused colleagues, artifacts disappearing during the move. So it looks like someone is stealing original antiquities, and it just gets worse.
Sounds fascinating. The House of the Sphinx, you already told us a little bit. This is involving bioterrorism, which has definitely affected all of us.
Yes. Well, I read Richard Preston's The Demon in the Freezer, and that's a nonfiction book. I mean, that's the story of the smallpox disease and how it was eradicated for the first time in the late 70s. But then the fact that, you know, there's some of this virus stored in a couple of laboratories, and what if it got loose? And it's just hair-raising, and there's quite a bit of true stuff in there. So when I was doing the research for this, I went to the Center for Disease Control webpage on my husband's advice and discovered they have a smallpox preparedness plan there that's very accessible. So it's like, wake up, folks, this could happen.
Yeah.
So that was the genesis of the book, that Lisa and James would be on a perfectly ordinary archaeological tour of Egypt. They're just being tourists, and then people start getting sick. So how do you avoid the disease? And in the course of this, Lisa and James get separated. Since James is a physician, he gets commandeered by some of the local medical organizations to deal with what is turning into an epidemic. And Lisa tries to work with a couple of other colleagues on finding out how the smallpox got transmitted in the first place.
Fascinating. And then your last book, it goes to the 1920s, and that's A Bootlegger's Nephew. And again, that ties in with another one of their local authors here that we have, that wrote a book called Sins of the South. And these are both taking place in the same era with same bootlegger people. Could you tell us a little about that?
Oh, I'll have to check out the other book. Yeah, well, this period also fascinated me. Of course, an awful lot is written about the Chicago area and Al Capone and all that, but I started reading about how much was going on in our part of central Illinois and over in Peoria and further south around Cairo. I thought it would be fun to write about my hometown in a different period, and this turned out to be absolutely fascinating because I got to visit the sites of former speakeasies that still exist in some of our buildings downstairs, downtown, and discovered there was actually a steam tunnel running underneath two streets where patrons could escape when the excise agents came. And that tunnel was there until at least 1990. And then there's a lot of other local information about what it was like. I was able to consult insurance maps from the 1920s that show the layout of our towns and where different businesses were located. So,
and this takes place where and what communities?
Champaign-Urbana.
Okay, Champaign-Urbana.
I call it Big Grove because that was originally the name of the town when the Indians and pioneers knew about it. So Big Grove actually refers to a clump of trees north of town where one of our parks is. So in the fiction book, it takes place in Big Grove, Illinois, and the University of Champaign, Urbana-Champaign, becomes the University of Big Grove.
Yeah, I think one of the things very interesting is, again, as I've studied and looked at this in not just years, Elliot Ness, who was responsible for breaking up Camp Capone, actually was involved in breaking up bootleggers in Champaign-Urbana before he went up to Chicago.
Yeah, but that was a little later than when my book takes place. But I did, of course, read about that.
Yeah. Would you care to read an excerpt from any of your books or anything? Just give an idea of something.
Okay. I will read a little bit of The Bootlegger's Nephew to give a flavor of it. And let's see. I'll try to squash this in. You tell me if we start to run out of time here. So this is Chapter 1, kind of sets the scene. The patient's breath stank of fermented foods overlaid with cheap alcohol, burnt sugar, and iodine. The smell of bad booze, hardly Chicago's best yak-yak bourbon. Doc Junker figured it was probably the same coffin varnish available in every blind pig between Big Grove and Kankakee. Good old Nathan Donaldson, car salesman, landowner, and looter of Indian graves, lay on the examining table in the former porch that served as Junker's home office. Cantankerous when sober, impossible when drunk, Nathan looked even worse than usual, with sweat beading on his bony forehead. Donaldson's hired hands, Hank and Larry, had dragged him in from the icy November rain and roused the doctor and his wife from a cozy, down-covered bed. Doc Junker sighed as he washed his hands in hot, soapy water. Nate, what in tarnation have you been up to this time? Any reason why you can't get yourself shot during office hours so I don't have to get up in the middle of the night? Ah, Illinois, I didn't plan it that way, Nathan gasped, shifting his gaze sideways. We had a burglar out at Dad's farm, and he was armed. He tried to shift his injured leg. Oh, cat turds, it hurts. Wishwa, said Junker. He didn't believe a word of it. Nathan's trousers were covered with dark splotches as if he'd been kneeling in dirt, and he had filthy fingernails. 10-1 he'd been digging on someone else's property, and the owner had shot him. Nathan and his son Frank shared Illinois Junker's passion for archaeology, but only for what they could sell from the sites they looted and mangled. If Junker got there first, he made sketches of the layout and excavated small sections bit by bit, recording everything and trying to picture the history of the people who lived and eaten and died on that spot. In contrast, the Donaldsons blasted through the layers looking for skulls and arrowheads and copper, scattering hearths and potsherds willy-nilly, making such a mess that no one who came after them could make any sense of it. Doc Junker was trying to convert Nathan to his systematic way of doing things, but it was an uphill battle. Nathan had rather strip a site and pinch all the good stuff for himself instead of working with anyone else. So, you got shot on your own property, not nearby at the Tate Farm, which we all know is a magnet for every criminal for miles around, and all sorts of nefarious nocturnal activities. Both properties lay just outside Big Grove to the southeast along the Salt Fork River. That put them not too far from the old saline springs that first drew entrepreneurs to Champaign County to mine salt. Ah, never mind where it happened. Just take the bullet out, would you? And dope me up good before you touch that leg. It's killing me, Nathan whined. Well, from the smell of you, Nate, you won't need ether or anything else. You're already spifflicated.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, that's probably good enough. Spifflicated is one of the many words that I learned for saying people are drunk in the 1920s, like ossified.
How can individuals get copies of your book to read? Where are they located, and where can they order them from?
Everything is on Amazon. That's the easiest way. A couple of local bookstores sporadically carry my books. I know Jane Addams downtown has a couple copies. We've lost some of our bigger bookstores. Barnes & Noble's may have a couple of them still. But the sad fact is, since I work with such small publishers, many stores don't stock them. So Amazon's the best way.
Okay, and again, your name is, give everybody your name and spell it for them again so they can understand.
Sarah Wissaman, that's Sarah with an H, S-A-R-A-H, and then Wissaman, W-I-S-S-E-M-A-N, and I have a website with that name. It's just www.sarahwissaman.com, and all the information is there.
And the books that you wrote, again, these are basic archaeological, historical type things, but fiction. Are yeah. Bound for Eternity, The Dead Sea Codex, Fall of Augustus, The House of Sphinx, and Bootlegger's Nephew.
And I should mention one more, the nonfiction book on the Mummy Project, The Virtual Mummy, that was published by the University of Illinois Press in 2003.
Wow, that's an accomplishment. Well, Sarah, thank you for joining us, and I think we're going to move over. Christine, have you been able to join us? Okay. Well... Hello, Chris?
Yeah, sorry about that. All of a sudden it popped in. I had the lid closed on my computer, and it just popped in anyway. Sorry.
Well, Sarah and Chris, I mean, we've got two of the authors that are going to be involved in the local authors' fair in Rantoul, Illinois, at the library in the middle of April. And so we've had a good time with Sarah. And Chris, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you.
Could you tell us a little about yourself and the books and what you do, Chris?
I am so sorry. There it goes again. If I could throw it out the window, I would. Let me move somewhere else. Okay, what was your question?
Yeah, tell us a little about yourself and your books that you've written and how you got into writing and what they're about, please.
I live here in Villa Grove, Illinois. And I write Christian horror fiction, and everybody thinks that's an oxymoron, but they just have to understand. If you want to try to peg me into, stick me in a what she writes like, it's a cross between Stephen King and Frank Peretti, if that gives you any idea.
Okay.
Okay.
And what are some of the books that you've written?
I've written five books so far, and I'm writing on a sixth. I've started out with a trilogy that is Bloodline, The Glass House. The second book in that trilogy is The Glass Heart. And the third one that I'm working on right now is The Glass Hill. I've also written Junkman and The Doll and Dawn and the Dead.
Wow, what was your original background that got you involved in writing books?
I had no background, really. I enjoyed writing when I was in high school, but I was terrified for anybody to read what I wrote because I was so insecure. But the death of the suicide of my little brother caused me to really bottom out, and I had a dream about a glass house that was so vivid I just decided to start writing it down, and before I knew it I started adding characters and everything else, and I wasn't even dreaming. It just took on a life of its own, and I wrote for six solid months, and in the process of all of that writing, God healed me of my brother's suicide, and I had a book on my hands that I didn't know what to do with. And I rewrote it several times, and I suddenly realized that God had given me the gift of writing in all of this, and I ended up publishing it on my own, and then later I became my own publisher. I have my own publishing company now, and I publish my own books.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it just took off from my first book was published in 2007, and I've written all these since. So,
What I mean, when we talked to Sarah, obviously Sarah was basing hers on a lot of archaeological fiction and a lot of truth and everything else. So could you describe some of the themes of your books that you've written? Give us an idea of what they're about and
sure.
what people could get from them if they picked them up to read them.
Yeah, the trilogy, the Bloodline trilogy, is based on a generational curse where a family, it started way back, like before history really began, this tribe called Alax, they used human sacrifice in their religion, and all of the tribe was related to each other because they didn't believe in going outside of the tribe because they felt like other blood was either tainted or it just wasn't up to snuff, and so their family was really getting lower they weren't suffering from any of the diseases that we suffer from, you know, when we do those kind of things. But what was happening was that their winters were so bad that they sacrificed to this miserable god of winter, okay? And a sacrifice went bad. If, you know, a human sacrifice went wrong, like any of them could go right, you know. But in this case, one of the people who was sacrificed and wasn't supposed to be cursed the tribe. And in the process, it created a monster. And this is the thing that has followed for generations, this family. And so it's kind of a weird generational curse, but it's based on curses on how they're handed down from, you know, like a curse of alcoholism, those kind of things, you know, that families seem to like abuse, you know, how they just keep going on and on. And that's what this kind of revolves around. And what happens is that I, in the process of all of these books that I'm writing, this is a trilogy, I'm leading people into the true answer to their problems, you know, of generational curses, anything that's going wrong in your life. And that's what all of my books are based on. It always comes back to God in the end. I even have a vampire book, believe it or not.
Really? Vampires?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the theme, the main theme of this is because a priest 500 years ago tried to exorcise a young girl without the proper spiritual backup, ended up becoming a vampire because this demon attacked him and turned him into a vamp demon. And the theme in this is, can and will God forgive anything? You know, everything. No matter what the situation. Because this guy was a priest, and now he's a vampire.
Wow.
So you can imagine what he's feeling.
Well, you know, you're talking here, and this is fascinating, because you started doing your books as a healing process, okay?
Uh-huh.
For yourself. Well, as we know, with all of us that are listening to Warrior Connection, involved the military and military people, we've been involved in so much, we have to go through our healing process of our own.
Right.
So we're reaching out all the time for figuring out ways to get healing processes done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, one of the key things we talked about this when Violet Lapine and I started putting this together for the local authors' fair for here and having you guys on our radio show is to give the idea people can use reading, they can use literature to relax and have fun, but you've just brought an entire different domain into it where you can actually use writing and literature to help you heal.
Right.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, a lot of my writing, there's so much of me in it, you know, because I went through hell with my brother's suicide. And you know, there were other things in my life that were also, you know, that were just monstrous for me. And so I guess some of that comes out in this, but in each book there's healing in it in some way. But I'm also reaching out to other people who have problems, you know, in their own lives, and there might be something of them that they see in this, and they will find out where their answer is. I have in The Doll, I also write with humor. This is not all so dark that it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm gonna, you know, you just have to wade through this and I'm gonna hurt all the time. But I have a lot of humor in my books also, and there's some romance. And in The Doll, I think the servicemen will especially like it because I have a man in here who is a Korean War vet who has become a hermit and has his own military compound in it. Believe it or not, in The Doll. And one of the background stories in it is that there's this pastor who has lost his family on his dad, who was a preacher also, on his retirement day. The family got together and you know, went to church, and then they came home, and a tornado came through and killed his dad, his wife, and his daughter, and paralyzed his mother, and he brought her back home with him to stay. And now he is questioning his faith because of all of this that happened. And he is the one who has to deal with this evil doll that is attacking this little girl and taking her over.
Fascinating. How did you? I mean, you wrote books, and then you got involved in publishing your own books. What is involved in that? How does? I mean, I can see a lot of individuals that, you know, have been in the military. They have incredible stories to tell. They have incredible adventures. They have incredible challenges in life. I mean, how can they get involved to direct all of this stuff towards the positive? Because from what I'm hearing, it really made a big difference in your life.
Oh, my gosh, yes. It became next to my husband, next to God and my husband, my third most important thing in my life. Yeah, it is. I went through they said they weren't a vanity publishing company, but they ended up being one, and spent so much money on my first book, getting it published, that and then I met somebody at the one of the local author events in Rantoul that's coming up, you know, in April. Mm-hmm. And we met at the very first one, and we've been there ever since. But she had been ripped off by a publishing company also, and she decided to do her own. And so we became friends, and we just fed off of each other, and we found somebody to do the cover for us. We found and somebody else to PDF it for us, because neither one of us know how to do that. I do my own editing, and I do a lot of my own photography for my covers, and I've learned how to design my own cover, you know, just from practice and trial and error. And then and we've also linked up with a printing company. We have bought our ISBN numbers, so we are official publishers, and now we do our own books. And it's about a fifth. It costs about a fifth of what it would if you went through a vanity publisher.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you know, a lot of professional authors, and what they would do, if they get a really good book or something, get to the one of major houses. This is where they'll come to you and ask you to write a book, or you've written a book and you take it to them, and then they give you an advance based on royalties and everything else, and how many books they can take.
It's so hard to break in to that. I tried. I tried to break into that with my first book. You're waiting 6 months sometimes for an answer, you know, from them, and then it's usually a rejection. And if you get an agent, it's the same way. It's even hard to get an agent. And I was close to 50 when I wrote my first book. So I figured by the time I got published, I'd be buried, and only my relatives would enjoy it. So at that rate, you know, waiting 6 months each time for an answer, because they don't like for you to submit them to several different houses at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, I decided that if I was going to see my first book published, I wanted to see it in my lifetime, because I started this so old, you know. Well, I'm only 60 now, but, you know, I've considered myself old at that time.
Could you give us what's a website that individuals could go to find your books?
Well, they can follow me on Facebook. Just key in Christine J. Trudeau, writer, and they can read excerpts from them. They can also go to Amazon.com, and four of my books are there. My first one that I published was a novella that I published on my own, and I don't have that on any of the sites other than getting it from me because I'm getting ready to put it in standard book form. This one's a novella, so it's not like that. So they can find me on Amazon.com, but they have to type in the J. Christine is spelled with a K. That's K-R-I-S-T-I-N-E. J, and Trudeau is spelled T-R-U-D-E-A-U.
Fabulous. Do you have an excerpt of your book that you'd like to read for us?
Yeah, I've got, I sure do. But they can also read full novels that I have put on for free that I have put on voicesnet.com if they want to get a taste of my writing, too.
And that's, again, what is that website?
Voicesnet.com.
Voices,
voicesnet.com.
Wow.
And for budding writers, it's a great place to go to just, you know, to try out your writing on people. And they're very kind to you. I'm one of the moderators there. And they're very kind to you, and they'll give you good advice. And you can just get your feet wet and get used to people reading your writing and saying something about it.
I know in the different workshops we've held since we put the local author's fair here at the Rantoul Public Library in East Central Illinois, we've had workshops where we had people come in and we reviewed their writing. We had how to write, how to do research, everything together. We've had all of you guys come in
mm-hmm.
and actually read from your books.
Right.
And I think you, and the last one last year, you did do a public reading of one of your books, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I read a part of The Doll, and it is, I timed myself, it's about 10 minutes long. So I don't know if you have time for that or not.
Yeah,
that,
we sure do.
That's the part where I have the Korean War veteran in.
Yeah, why don't
and
you
I think
go ahead
would
and read
enjoy that.
That? We've got the time.
Okay, super. I'll read that. I'd like to read this one. Okay, this is Chapter 11. I'm going to read the back of the book first so you get an idea of what it's really about. Hurt and loneliness were all little Sarah Kinnery had ever known in her short life until she found a doll buried in the dirt floor of her grandmother's woodshed. The miserable conditions Sarah endured daily created the perfect atmosphere to revive the doll, magic. Taking little persuasion on the doll's part to convince a lonely little girl that she now has a friend, magic begins the process of taking control of Sarah. When a neighbor woman takes an interest in Sarah's change of behavior and becomes a target for magic's wrath, the doll shows its true nature to anyone who dares interfere in its plans. Chapter 11 starts with Julian, the pastor I was telling you about, who had lost his family.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on his way now because he realizes that he's going to have to do something about this. Pastor Julian Birch's idea of arming himself was finding someone who had weapons and knew how to use them. There was only one man that he knew personally who fit that bill, Bruce Friday. Julian hadn't seen the bruiser since before spring, and he doubted if his friend even knew why. Friday was a Korean War veteran, Special Forces. He came home with a medical discharge and a whole different outlook on life. Sometime during the war, one of the circuits in his brain turned south, and Bruce Friday became a hermit, a paranoid armed hermit, with a man-made fallout shelter and personal military compound. About 5 miles northwest of town, Julian pulled off the main road onto a dirt path leading into the woods. He followed the path for about half a mile and reached a clearing with an electric fence and a padlocked gate. A wooden sign hung on the gate, no trespassing. Julian knew the drill. He honked 3 times, waited 5 seconds, and honked once, laying on the horn for 3 seconds. Within seconds, lights came on all over the place. Julian could see a small stand of trees in the center of a circular clearing. The electric fence was set on the perimeter of the clearing. Trees had been cleared away from both sides of the fence so that no one could climb a tree and jump over the fence or propel from tree to tree to get over the fence that way. Friday liked his privacy. It wasn't long until headlights were seen coming from the trees in the center of the clearing. An old rusted truck pulled up at the gate, and a large muscular figure got out of the driver's side door and walked up to the gate. Julian got out of his car and stood beside it. Even though Bruce Friday didn't have a gun in his hand, Julian knew the man carried one on him. It would have to be shoved down in his boot or stuck in the back of his pants at the waistband. The bruiser never took any situation at face value, ever. "What the hell are you doing out here in the middle of the night, Jay?" yelled the big man. Bruce was the only one who called Julian Jay. Julian was nicknamed Julie during grade school because he was smaller than most of the kids in his class. He hated the name Julie. For some reason, the school bully named Bruce, the bruiser, Friday, befriended Julian. No one dared call him Julie when the bruiser was with him. Once Julian's height caught up with everyone else's, everyone but Julian forgot Julie. Some memories hurt forever. "I don't hear from you for months. Now you come out here messing with my beauty sleep. You woke Killer up, and he'll be screwed up for a week." "If you'll shut up for a minute, I'll tell you why I'm here," said Julian. "Let me unlock the gate, and I'll take you up in the house," said Bruce. He rubbed his eyes. "I need some coffee." Julian reached in the car and turned off the ignition lights. There was no need to lock the car. No one in his right mind would come around here anyway. Word gets out fast when a maniac meets you at his gate with a loaded rifle. Rumors had it that Friday had planted landmines in the woods. It wasn't true, but Friday let them believe it. "Quieter that way," he said. Bruce placed a black and white enameled painted coffee pot on his iron stove, threw wood into the door below it, and lit it. "Let's go back outside," he said. "It's cooler out there." As soon as they drew near the screened-in back porch, Julian heard a string of cuss words come through the doorway. "Shut up, killer," said Bruce. "Good land, Bruce," said Julian. "When are you going to teach that bird some respectable words?" Bruce lit a kerosene lantern, turned the flame down. Julian could now see the agitated white cockatiel walking back and forth on his perch. As if in answer to Julian's question, the bird bobbed its head up and down and said, "Moron." Julian laughed. Bruce lit a cigarette and sat in a metal chair. He motioned for Julian to sit in the other one. "What's going on, man?" Bruce asked. "Where have you been?" It was always Julian who came to visit Bruce. Bruce only left his property once a month to collect his mail, his service retirement check, and buy the things he couldn't grow or make on his own property. Bruce's world was nearly self-sustaining. Having to leave his property for those 2 hours was traumatic for him, but a necessity he forced himself to endure. Some people considered him obsessive because he always bought the same things in the same amounts and never deviated from his list. Store clerks quickly learned, run and get the store manager as soon as a strange man from out in the country comes through the door because he refuses to deal with anyone other than the store manager or owner. The bruiser didn't like having to break in new people and refused to explain himself to anyone. Bruce knew exactly what it took to keep him and Killer alive for 2 years, and that's how many supplies he kept in storage from food to gasoline, wood, and water. He rotated his stock to keep it fresh. "Dad, Pam, and Kathy are dead," said Julian. Bruce didn't say anything for a couple of minutes. The silence grew between them. Even Killer sensed it was wise to keep his beak shut. Bruce took a long drag on a cigarette, blowing the smoke out between pursed lips before he said, "That's not why you're here, though, is it?" "No." "Geez, Jay," said Bruce. "You come out here in the middle of the night, in the damn dark, and you're going to sit there and say no?" "I need your help, Bruce," said Julian. "And you're going to think I've lost my mind and throw me back out there to deal with this problem by myself when I tell you what's going on. I was crazy to even come here. What? Have the commies invaded Old Town or something? Asked Bruce. I told you it was going to happen. Commies are coming! Commies are coming! Screamed Killer. No, no, said Julian. He had to refrain from laughing hysterically at the insanity of the whole situation. Here he was, sitting in the home of his best friend, a paranoid recluse who was expecting the imminent invasion of communists, and Julian needed this guy to kill a doll. Who was the crazy in this case? Might as well spill it. Julian, it's not going to sound sane no matter how you tell him. I need you to kill a doll, said Julian. Bruce choked on his cigarette smoke. It took him a few minutes to stop laughing before he realized Julian was serious. Sorry, man, said Bruce. He wiped his eyes with the back of his cigarette hand. Okay, tell me why I need to kill a doll. He giggled through the last two words, then got himself back under control. Because if you don't, said Julian, it won't be long before there will be more of them, and pretty soon they'll make their way out here. I'm listening, said Bruce. Commies are coming, screamed Killer. I'm ending here.
That's fascinating. That's excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You know, I guess we're coming back, and again, we're starting to wind down in time here, ladies and gentlemen. We've had some really neat authors on today. They've had read excerpts of their book. And what's really neat is our first author, Sarah Wesserman, again, talked about archaeological history and used real-life events to put together archaeological fiction. And now, Christine, you brought a whole other domain in here where you're writing books to help us heal. I mean, it's fascinating, totally, totally fascinating. Is there any suggestions that you could give to individuals that are listening? Again, the Progress Radio Network, we're moving forward, we're providing education, ideas, thoughts, and everything for you. Christine, is there anything you could give suggestions on how people could get involved in writing books and what they should go about and how they start?
How they start is writing the first sentence. That's how anything starts. You can sit there and stare at a blank piece of paper for hours, but until you get that first sentence written down, it's not going to go anywhere. Everybody, I believe truly that each person has at least one book inside of them. You've probably heard that before. And it is true, whether it is fiction, some story or some dream that you've had, a recurring dream even, whether something that has happened in your life or someone else's life, like a parent or someone. I've got a friend who writes about his ancestors, and some of it is fiction and some of it is true. And, you know, but he molds it into a story. And there's just main thing is just start writing. And then go to a workshop or take a writing course. I took a writing course just because it had been so long since I'd done any kind of writing, you know, poetry or anything. I've written hundreds of poems now. And take a course to help you if you feel rusty. And please don't write in texting. That's one thing you shouldn't do. People text so much now they've forgotten how to write. but just start writing it down, and then give it to a trusted friend, or bring it to something like our author's fair. There's probably one in your area, no matter where you live, and take it there and let somebody read it, or just do that and just start getting your feet wet.
Well,
so that's
great.
That's my idea.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is very interesting. Christine, thank you very much. I want to thank Sarah for coming on. And both of their books are on Amazon.com, or you'll contact them. We'll put contacts up on the website.
Thank you.
Thank you very again. Thank you, Christine.
You're
Have
welcome.
A good evening.
Bye-bye.